30-minute love affair. It's not the time, it's the quality, surely. Anyway, it's Siren 107.3 FM, the Midweek Drive. In the studio, we have Professor Brian Winston and Professor Gail Van Stone. And online now, yes, no longer just a button that we actually press because she's in America doing or around the globe doing various book tours, etc. We, of course, welcome the one and only Michelle Monroe. How are you, Michelle?
Good afternoon. How are you? Pretty good.
But as always, I think you need to ask the co-presenters that in terms of, you know, how they've been feeling, the programme's been going. We're halfway through now, quite literally, 3,600 seconds clocked under. And Brian, do you feel as though we've looked clearly at Gail's fabulous work in terms of early feminist movie makers and the first wave and the second wave in Canada, focused on your Emmy award-winning scenario. We've looked at nutrition and, of course, we had a fair dash of country music as well. Has it been going well?
I think so, yes. I am especially pleased about the radioactive pills.
There you go. You see where we're going on this one, Michelle. And Gail, your first show, how's your whole experience been so far?
I was just sitting here thinking it has been terrific.
Well, you see, standards, Michelle, that's what we need to maintain.
We've always got high standards on Siren 107.3 FM.
Crucial.
Quite clearly.
So, this particular cover version, once again...
Well, you see, now I've got something very special for you, because this week's song comes from the pens of John Lennon and Paul McCartney and was featured on the Beatles' second LP with the Beatles in 1963. It was produced by George Martin. Now, the original version is quite fast and, as you'd expect from the Beatles, guitar-driven. George, always on the lookout for material for Dad, spotted something in the song that would lend itself to a ballad treatment. So, on the 3rd of November, 64, my Dad entered Abbey Road Studios to record a new arrangement by Johnny Spence. However, the arrangement lacked something, so George asked Johnny if he could make a few changes. Matt returned to the studio on the 8th of January the following year and recut the song, which now had additional instruments added to the arrangement. It was first issued in 1965 on the album I Have Dreamed in the UK and became the title track of the USS release of the same year. Now, incidentally, the November 64 version of the song will be issued for the first time ever next month on the new album Matt Uncovered the Rarer Monroe. Now, Lennon and McCartney were asked about Dad's recording of the song and said, "It's fine, you know. He did it how people imagine it should be done." After Matt Monroe did it, everybody said, "Oh, that's a nice song, isn't it?" Whereas beforehand, they just thought it was a gay little ditty. And it still is. But it changed a few people's minds about us, I think. The song they were talking about? All My Loving.
And to
Brian Winston, what did you make of that little number?
Well, I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I mean, I must confess I'd never heard it before, and it really does work. And Martin was a genius, of course, I think, as they were.
I shared his birthday,
and he has a very nice voice.
Exactly, yes. George Martin, I think, also born on the 3rd of January, but again, he's still alive. I don't want to point that out because it wasn't until relatively recently that Ernest Borgnine passed on, which I was referred to. I thought he'd actually gone a few years ago, but never mind.
George got marvellous at the book launch, didn't he?
He was very good. We connected with him last year, of course, when it was the official launch of the paperback version of The Singer's Singer. Mm. Gail, what did you make of All My Loving a la Matt Monroe?
I loved it. He has a gorgeous voice. It's really, he's sort of nubile, and he can, you know, he takes a phrasing, and just when you think he's going to finish, it becomes more intense, and it's really beautiful.
Yes. Thank you.
Actually, we were almost in tears in the studio here, Michelle. It's sort of emotionally overwhelmed.
Well, I like to bring the different tracks to you each week, as you know, and the whole point is of playing stuff that people not necessarily have heard before.
Exactly.
Give them an airing, as they say.
Well, yeah, it's spreading the word. A little look ahead. Tomorrow morning, of course, we have our Scottish author and former erstwhile musician, Peter Kerr, joining us, who was also produced by Peter Martin with this little number. I think think that's quite enough for now. You'll hear the full unexpurgated version of that on the show tomorrow, but it is quite extraordinary.
That would lend itself to a ballad.
Might need to just slow the tempo down slightly. I don't know, it would sort of... A sort of ironic ballad, perhaps.
I'll ask George to work on it.
it's a definite thought. Michelle, there was a little treat for luxury fans of Matt Munro that we said we'd actually mention because we got an email from, in fact, Jodie Orton from the American Dream Team show, who actually said, "Oh, you must mention this. I thought of this when I saw it, and I thought of Michelle Munro as well, because you could still actually get hold of the absolutely superlative box set package of Matt Munro goodies." Would you like to share what's in it from Titan Publications, or do I need...
Oh, I see. That's goodies.
Yes.
Yeah, that could have been an Easter egg.
It could, exactly.
No, we're talking about the rare limited edition of the singer, which is packaged only available on either Amazon or from Titan Direct. And the reason that I loved doing the project so much was that Titan did give me leeway to do this special edition. So, as well as having the normal book in it, it has a secondary book, which includes all Dad's sessionographies that he did. You know, what studio, when, how, what musicians, how many takes. It's the whole history. As well as, of course, his, all his TVs, all his radios, and in fact, a discography. And then tucked in away at the back is an extremely rare 20-track CD of tracks that have never been released before and indeed won't be released on anything else in the future.
And to answer the question that occasionally is put to us, folk actually say, so Michelle Munro has been working with you on the Midweek Drive now for nigh on 2 years, actually, Michelle, in various ways. We're looking at sort of 2017, 2018 before we even start having to repeat any Matt Munro tracks for the back catalogue.
We're still going strong, actually. I can't even say that we're dipping near the end of the barrel.
No.
And of course, as you know, I'm sorry to be notorious with the plugs, but in fact, the 13th of next month, the new album comes out, which, as the title would indicate, with the rare Munro,
yes,
these are tracks that haven't been released before. So, in fact, there'll be 60 new editions to the catalogue. So that gives us more.
Well, that's 2013 taking place, exactly. Yes, it's very important from that point of view. Any final questions for Michelle?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, what a sort of gorgeous and satisfying venture it must be to be touring around with the back catalogue. And, I mean, Michelle, you're obviously in possession of a wealth of knowledge. Have you ever thought about writing a book?
Ah, well, yeah, there we are, you see. Yes, it's called The Singer's Singer. 650 pages of sheer delight, and we're already talking about the possible movie rights.
Uh-huh. Oh, this sounds fabulous.
Yeah, that's what I've been touring with, promoting the release of the paperback, because, in fact, it came out 2 years ago on hardback, and thankfully it won an award in America, actually, an Irwin Award. And
congratulations.
Thank you, and it's done very well. And the nice thing about it, it's not just about my feelings for my father. It's, for me, it's about promoting and keeping the legacy he left behind, you know, glowing brightly, making sure that there's longevity still, because there aren't many artists that are still being played, you know, 50, 60 years on. And certainly not from more recently, a lot of the artists have been and gone. Mm. But the 60s produced some wonderful, wonderful talent. And hopefully, you know, through people like Alex, who play the music constantly, and
We do play other pieces of music, obviously, Michelle.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
but
much
it should be played in another 50 years, and that's what the aim is.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, no, I think, I mean, you obviously have your finger on a pulse of a really vital aspect of music history.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I mean, because he was one of Britain's biggest exports, and there was a huge contribution to the business, as you say, which is part of the history of it, of Tin Pan Alley and the days of Denmark Street and the like. So, yes, it's nice to be able to keep that fresh in people's minds. And, you know, a lot of the artists of today, your Michael Bublés and the like, their inspiration came from artists like my father.
Indeed.
You know, and they often take a song from an older day and give it a new revamp. It's
right.
Not necessarily a new song.
Michelle, as ever, the clock is just ticking remorselessly through the whole thing.
I know, you never give us enough time.
Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us?
Me, no.
That's fair enough. Are you
with
back
Gail
again?
And, yes, I have.
Yeah, there you go. Are you back again next week?
It's always a pleasure, you know that. And you know you'll see me next Wednesday, same time. Can't get it back.
Which I suppose is only apt, really. We did say we'd play some Gordon Lightfoot, and we went for If You Could Read My Mind, because I thought it was important to keep the Canadian theme going. And If You Could Read Your Mind would obviously be telepathic, and then you'd have no end of ways of coming up with strange plot lines, many of which would have manifested in some of the superlative work that was produced and written by our ace American writer, Arthur Weingarten. Arthur, how are you?
I'm well. I'm broiling. It's about 34 Celsius here and has been for the past week.
Well, I'm sure the thunderstorms will be coming along before too long. That's the important thing. Now, quick introductions to our two professors of the studio. We have Emmy Award-winning documentary maker and scholar Professor Brian Winston and Professor Gail Vanstone. And Brian has just received a copy, or at least I just passed over a copy, of the text we spoke about on your last connection with the Madrid Drive, which is The Sky is Falling. And you know, to be fair, I think it's an astoundingly good read and a fine piece of investigative journalism, Brian.
Well, it certainly seems to be so, but I wonder, Arthur, you haven't reissued it. Nobody's had the sense to reissue it in the light of more recent events or whatever. I mean, this is about a crash into a tall skyscraper in New York.
In fact, the
Empire State Building. Yes. Which presumably have all sorts of resonances.
Well, yes, yeah, I think that's one of the reasons they didn't do it.
Oh, right, yes, okay, that hadn't occurred to me. I was thinking exactly the other way. We have a colleague here, well, not a colleague, a visiting professor called Alex Graham, who came up in the year 2000 with he wanted to do something about a terrorist disaster and the responses, and to do it grounded so thoroughly in research and planning that it could be a sort of documentary about an event that hadn't happened yet. And then, of course, the attack on the towers took place, and they had to give up on the towers because they'd actually come up with a similar plot line to that.
And
it became smallpox instead.
As Phil Linus will also attest to, his colleague Dean Hagland, part of the Lone Gunman, they'd actually done a TV pilot which featured a terrorism attack into the World Trade Center several months before the actual thing happened.
So you did have discussions about it, but people felt it was not appropriate.
Oh, yeah. There are so many of these things that go on. But then again, you see, publishing is... television is everything, is a commercial venture, and if you're going to have even the slightest negative going in, reticence rules.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Yeah. Oh. But still, I'm fascinated to know about.
There is a continual, I don't benefit from it, but a continual number of books sold constantly on eBay and all those other places, so, you know.
Oh, this book, your book, The Sky's Falling.
Yes, yeah, right. I don't benefit from it.
No, well, I know that.
But at least it's out there, yeah.
Clearly, Arthur, we're going to have to set up some kind of broadcast-a-thon to actually ensure that we actually get this thing sorted out once and for all, really. It's unbelievable. Let's progress onwards from that point of view. Obviously, recently we had the sad demise of Ernest Borgnine. Did you ever work with Ernest? Ernie was one of the legends of Hollywood in your sort of TV time at Hollywood.
No, as a matter of fact, I never worked with him, but he and I would share a end of a bar at Universal Studios about three times a week. When he was in between shooting and I was in between shooting, we'd go into this bar, not because of the two of us. We became friendly because of that. But the bar was the place you could avoid everybody you didn't want to run into, because it was in the middle of the day and hardly used at all. So that's how we became friendly.
I only met him once, and my son's academic success is entirely due to him, because he was a guest at the National Film Theatre when I was on the board of the British Film Institute, and my son would come along. He was a teenager, and he was about to take his school exams, Arthur. And obviously, he was the only kid meeting, you know, in the gathering after the session that Borgnine did in the theatre. And Borgnine said, "So what are you doing, kid?" I said, "Oh, he's taking his important school exams tomorrow." And Borgnine said, "Give him hell!" And I put down his success to that.
Good
wish. Yeah, well, there you are. He was a lovely fellow.
He was smashing that evening, I have to say. He was really lovely.
No, he was a genuine fellow. There was no airs about him. He knew his worth as an actor. I mean, there was no false modesty about that. But he didn't use it to further anything, and he was an interesting character.
Yeah, he didn't have to, it seems.
Oh.
Yeah, he was fine.
I was reminded of the MacArthur line, which I think echoed that. Give them hell, and if they don't like it, give them more hell.
Right.
Very confusing, that might be. Let's be more positive about the whole thing. Gail, we talked about, obviously, the resurgence of the Canadian filmic industry. Were you conscious? I mean, presumably, it's a rather facile question, really. Were you conscious of the sort of the things that are happening south of the border with women in Hollywood and various other things as well in your research?
Yeah, of course. But what I'm actually interested to ask you, Arthur, what do you make of what's going on in sort of primetime drama television these days?
I must say I have to opt out pretty much because I find it not to my liking for the things that I've seen. Now that's
right.
You know, but I find it derivative, like all things in life. I mean, you can start with Shakespeare being derivative, but I find it terribly derivative, and I find that there is such a sameness, even when it's not derivative, they seem to be feeding on each other. So I tend not to watch too much. I always dip in at the beginning of the season to see what's going on, and then I seem to stay away from it.
Yeah, no, I'm fascinated because I share your feelings, but there's a Canadian scriptwriter, a guy named Chris Haddock, who had a very contentious primetime television program, television drama in Canada. It was sort of peremptorily cut off mid-season, and he's gone to New York, I think, to work on the team of The Good Wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm interested to see what will happen there. And
yeah,
so you're in the thick of things.
Yeah, the thing with and I find all things return to laughter. I worked in early television days, for me, early television days, not England, who was first with television, but in the late 50s and 60s in England, where it was the same old, and the terribly commercial stuff that I was doing at the same time in California and in New York seemed adventurous. I think the reverse is true today. I think England is in the forefront. Great Britain, not just England, but things coming out of Scotland and this and that, is far superior to what we're doing here. I think they're far more adventurous, and that is for a country that I used to roll my eyes all the time and say, when are you going to take a chance, you know, do something that is risky? Well, they are now. They are. And I give them full credit. There are things that I've seen that put to shame what's being done here.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've been listening with great envy to Brian talking about the kinds of television dramas that he's able to tap into. And I think Canada's a bit marooned in all of this.
No.
Yeah.
Sadly.
He gave the world William Shatner and Shane Rimmer.
I know.
You know, what greater accolades can you have?
But then he didn't stay.
No, it's Shatner. I made a film.
And what about Daddy Bonanza?
Lorne Green.
Well, of course.
Lorne Green, yes.
Yeah. Lorne Green, yes, and Monty Hall. Let's make a deal.
Well, yes, no, Monty Hall. Monty Hall is fabulous.
And Dean Haglund, you know, let's promote the joys of Canada.
Yeah.
Dr. Fiona
Moore.
It's fantastic.
You see, they're also, too, I must say, I did a couple of pilots up in Canada, maybe 15, 20 years ago. And I found the same thing there that which you just mentioned, that the two were Canadian derivative, started out in Canada, and I was brought in because of the American connection.
Right.
And they were far more adventurous than what was being done there, and both died a death. That was it.
Right.
It wasn't going to go anywhere.
Well, yeah. No, and now, of course, we've got some really fascinating, hilariously funny shows from Newfoundland artists.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
you're not allowed to make fun of Newfoundlanders anymore.
Hell no.
Newfoundlanders are making fun of everybody else. I mean, you know, talk about global warming upheavals.
Apart from that, Brian, you just slipped in the little line there saying he once made a movie with the Shatner himself.
Basically. I did, yes.
So you've got to share with us. What was it? How did it?
Well, most Canadian movies, they had a wonderful law where they gave you a tax write-off and you got $3 for a dollar. Every dollar you spent on a movie, you could take off $3 of tax. So we made a movie that was... The only problem about making these movies was that they couldn't make any money. Because if you started making a profit, then the whole deal was off.
So much like academic work, then.
Well, absolutely. So we made a real stinker of a movie with Shatner and with Colleen Dewhurst. And it was... I always say, you know, most Canadian movies... weren't seen except on cable television. But ours wasn't even seen on cable television. Okay.
Was this pre or post TJ Hooker era, Shatner?
Oh, this was post
TJ Hooker.
Oh, post everything. Yes, oh. I mean it was directed by one of Marshall McLuhan's daughters, if you remember. '60s gurus.
Global Village.
Terry was a friend, and I helped to produce it. It was a complete nightmare from beginning to end. I've never done anything ever again on that side of the business, right?
Well, you see, it was your bad luck not to do the producers.
No, well, yes, exactly. Well, it was very much like the producers, I have to say. I mean, once bitten, twice shy. No, I'm not cut out for fiction, I'm afraid.
We're not going to do Springtime for Hitler for anybody's money. It's not going to happen, you know, not at this moment in time. Arthur, have you got any questions you want to put to Brian about his time within documentary filmmaking and academic work and all the other bits and pieces?
Yes, I am such a documentary film fan, I can't tell you. And over here, it's worth your life to try and find them, one on television. Our PBS plays a thing called Frontline and POV, but that's once a week, and that's about it. And you have to search out in the Village IFC theaters that show some documentaries. But Canada, number one, and England has always produced beautiful, beautiful documentaries. Are you doing anything now? Is there something I should be looking out for?
Well, not. I made a film about Robert Flaherty, who's the father of documentary, made in a nuke.
Yeah.
I wrote the script for that, which was made by the Irish and released a couple of years ago, and it's doing quite well in the way of these things. But you're absolutely right. It's always been of extreme marginal importance. And what's been interesting, though, ever since Michael Moore managed to get into the mall cinemas, is that you can actually occasionally find films, normally ones that are quite satiric or a bit out of the ordinary, or these days even ecological ones like, An Inconvenient Truth, which actually do reach a broader big screen audience. And then there are things like the Discovery Channel and so on, although much of the work is, as you say, as you were saying, of the fictional work, it's sort of repetitive and derivative and so on.
Oh, yes. But, and now, of course, being exploitive, like Michael Moore, you know, it gets further and further away from pure documentary.
Oh, sure, yes. But we seem to be having quite a rich period now, and people are able to do all sorts of things, at least at the level of, you know, the style and everything else and the subject matter. The money, of course, remains completely... the big thing at the moment, this will not bring joy to you any more than it does to me, is that the new technologies are being touted as a basis for everybody doing it, so they don't need guys like us anymore.
You mean citizen journalism is not
citizen journalism
in the form?
And all of that, and they keep showing up.
Yeah.
And
yes, yeah. Well, if you pay your cell phone bill, you're a documentary maker.
That's right, exactly. Yes.
I have you here, and it just dawned on me, I finally found the perfect person I can ask this to, an academic and also a Canadian.
Uh-oh.
What got me interested? No, this isn't my gotcha thing. This is accolades. What got me interested in documentaries? I was still in grade school when my parents took me to see my first foreign feature film in Brooklyn. There was a little theater that showed them on Fridays only. And as instead of a Looney Tunes cartoon before, they showed Mail Train.
Oh, wow.
Nightmail.
By
Humphrey Jennings. Yes.
Nightmail.
By Basil Wright. I'm losing the plot. Basil Wright, yes, Nightmail. And you liked it.
Not only did I like it, it stayed with me so much that I decided I was going to try and be in
the movies.
In film.
There you go.
And I was perhaps 12 or 13 at that point. But I remember being so captivated by the starting out from beginning to end of how this played out. A mundane thing of getting your mail, and it suddenly said to me, my goodness, there is a world out there that you could select anything and make it interesting talent.
Without those extras actually doing in their sort of added slots and various other bits and pieces.
Well, first of all, I mean, you had W.H. Auden and a few other
poets.
And Britain and a few other people
exactly.
like that, giving it a bit of a helping hand. But you know that the mail train, the interior, I worked at the National Film School here in Britain for years, which is at Beaconsfield, and the Beaconsfield Studios, they shot the interiors at the Beaconsfield Studio. Harry Watt has the Harry Watt was the main director. He tells this wonderful story that they couldn't afford a rocker set. You know, that's a set which has the motors
right.
that rock things. So they had to, every time they did the interior of the guys sorting the letters, and they're the mailmen. They're not actors, right?
Yeah.
They're sorting the letters, right? But just before they took the shot, they knocked all the pieces of string. So the strings were, you know, the bits of string hanging. They tie the bundles. Some letters up, so the strings were moving as if the train was moving. Right.
Much the same thing as when the Starship Enterprise was hit by phasers. It used to rock from side to side.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Same sort of scenario.
Absolutely.
Arthur, I got this wonderful impression now of Nightmare being responsible for $6 Million Man, Wonder Woman, Green Hornet, all sorts of magical things.
Actually, there was a nice piece about Wonder Woman in the paper the other day about Linda doing.
Carter.
Linda Carter. Mind's going.
Yes.
My mind really is going. Linda Carter doing all this good work about various things and not...
Galt's Brain, of course, that classic classic adventure, which Arthur kindly sort of sent over a copy of the script, etc. Where else can you go? Arthur, it's been splendid as ever. Have you had another reasonably interesting telephonic link with us?
Oh,
in the
I
drive?
Certainly have. Yeah, you have wonderful guests. Really do, and it's been a pleasure. It really has. Night train, not mail train, night train.
There you go.
I'm going to get it from Netflix.
Night mail,
yeah.
Not night train. Night mail.
Night mail.
Night train. You could get some sort of adult interpretation. You don't want to go there at all in any way, shape, or form. So I take it, Arthur, you'll be back again with us next month.
I will. Thank you very much, and goodbye to all.
Okay. Lovely to meet you.